Our castaway this week is John Barker. He was born in Kilburn in 1948, his family moving to Willesden shortly after. His mother and father were both Geordies who were traditionally Labour supporters. His grandfather had been a unionist and Labour councillor in Newcastle. John was a bright child, and after attending a local primary school, he went first to Haberdashers, an independent school in North London, and then to Cambridge University. He imagined a career for himself as an academic or journalist. At Cambridge, he was exposed for the first time to what he calls the children of the ruling classes on their way to being the next ruling class. They were, he says, dreadful people. He became increasingly involved with the politics of the radical left, being active in a street theatre company, associating with the Situationists, and organising a boycott with six others of his final exams. He came to public attention as a member of the Angry Brigade, who were tried in 1971 for causing 25 explosions between 1968 and 1970. He conducted his own defence, but in spite of blatant dishonesty on the part of the police, was found guilty and was sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. The state had, as he said, framed a guilty man. John, welcome to Dissident Island Discs. You said they framed a guilty man. Do you feel guilty?
Guilty about what? Guilty in general? I have some kind of Protestant thing in my head which I never quite do enough, never done enough to make the world a better place, never done enough to be a good parent. These kinds of guilt I feel, and in a sense, even though guilt doesn't do anybody, doesn't actually do anybody any good, I think if we didn't have some sense of guilt, or perhaps some sense of right and wrong, and that one doesn't live up to these things, I think we'd be in a lot of trouble if we had no sense of guilt at all.
We'll talk about the Angry Brigade and your imprisonment later, but first of all, can you tell us a little bit about your first choice of music?
My first record is Stravinsky's Petrushka, which is a ballet. It's ballet music. I'm very fond of it because when I was 12 or 13, my sister, who's quite a bit older than me, had a very, very eclectic selection of records, one of which was this Petrushka. And I love the music. It's a... The ballet is the story of these puppets in a puppet show in Russia, in a fair in Russia. And it ends in tragedy because the Petrushka hero, who's a doll, is dumped and punished by the other guy for the girl he's in love with. And I love the music because it really makes you feel as though you could be in a fairground in Russia.
That was the first tableau from the ballet Petrushka by Stravinsky. So your family moved to Willesden shortly after you were born. What are your abiding memories of being a boy in North London in the 50s?
Very happy. Incredible freedom. I mean, compared to kids today, I mean, I was out, we had a... I lived very close to a park called Gladstone Park. I mean, it was, you know, 2 minutes away. And I spent, you know, most of my free time in this park playing football in the winter and cricket, which was still a very big thing in the 50s. I love playing cricket. So I'd be out in the park till all hours, and I didn't, you know, my mother wasn't on my case about it, and there was none of that. My abiding memory is very much of this, of a freedom which seems to a lot of kids now almost unimaginable.
You've spoken before about your mother being religious. To what degree do you think was the moral framework of your childhood dictated by your mother's Christianity?
I guess that it laid certain foundations. Yes, I can't. She was a Christian. It would appear now that most Christians appear to be extremely unchristian people. I mean, you know, the American religious right and so on, and evangelicals in this country who are becoming stronger appear to be totally unchristian, as I saw it, which involved compassion, being able to put yourself in the other's shoes. It's mostly, having a sense of compassion which overcame any other kind of reservations that you might have. And I suppose as it seems now, probably childish admiration for Jesus as a man who stuck to his guns, so to speak.
And John, when was the first time you can remember making a decision for yourself that something was morally wrong?
That was when I was about nine, I think. A guy was being, in my primary school, somebody was being bullied. And even though the bully was bigger than me, I stepped in and I fought the bully. I think I was about nine, maybe ten.
Tell me about your next choice of music.
My next choice of music is Georgie Fame, and the record's called In the Meantime. Georgie Fame was a fabulous, proper R&B singer and Hammond organ player, who I think his work stands up now. And the great thing about him was that he was the first person who did all-nighters. I feel I owe a lot to Georgie Fame. I had some great nights when he was doing these all-nighters, and I took my first drugs, which were black bombers, which were a form of dexedrine, which you can't get anymore, which were fabulous for all-nighters. So, and I think he's a great singer. But in the meantime, such a lean time, booty, you'll have a hard time, because I wanna live it up this way. That's why I gotta change my style, you say. Give up my some loving in the meantime. I'm gonna need some catching in the meantime. I'm gonna be a meantime man. Oh, pretty baby, I've always been like this now. No one can change me. But if you love me like I think you do, you're gonna understand I'll change for you. Give up my gals and wine, so you can see I'm gonna need some loving in the meantime. I'm gonna need some catching in the meantime. I'm gonna be a meantime man. So now I know, yeah, you're gonna save my soul. Just change my style, but you better know me why. I really love you.
That was Georgie Fame performing In the Meantime. So you were in your teens in London in the mid-60s. That must have been an exciting time.
Well, it was exciting by the time I was 15, it was exciting. Yeah, so around 63, 64, it was very exciting. I'd actually, the Georgie Fame song is the most, because that's when I really started to go and have a good time on my own in the West End.
And you had moved from your local primary school to the independent school Haberdashers in North London, away from most of your friends. It must have had quite an effect on you.
As independent schools are, it's very privileged because they do, at least within certain parameters, they do encourage you to think critically. You know, this is absolutely forbidden, in as far as I can see, for people who are not privileged, who don't get a relatively privileged education. The critical thinking is not encouraged at all, but I think, you know, within certain parameters, it was encouraged. So it was, you know, it excited my head.
And what about your contemporaries at Haberdashers? Did you see yourself as one of them?
Yes and no. Most of them were probably a lot better off than my family. But I think I've said this before, that the best bit about it was there were a lot. This school was full of a lot of Jewish kids from Northwest London whose parents, a lot of them had been emigres from Europe, very cultured people, but, you know, not with any sense of superiority towards you, and actually very kind people who, I would say cultured, and would encourage people, would encourage us to, you know, listen to difficult music, or music that appeared to be difficult anyway.
Can you talk a little about your next piece of difficult music?
Well, my next musical choice is actually has nothing to do with these nice cultured people. It's in fact a tune by Dudu Pakwana. I was lucky enough to catch them at... because this was the other music I really liked, was jazz music. And Ronnie Scott, who was then doing very well, his club that still exists in Frith Street, was, you'd get all the top American stars coming. And then in a moment of, from what I gather about Ronnie Scott, unusual generosity, he reopened his original club, which was in a cellar in Gerrard Street, and called it The Old Place. And there, a lot of very young, unknown British jazz players and also the South African band came to play.
That was Dudu Pakwana and the Chris McGregor Band playing Nick Tett. So between finishing school and going to university, you worked in a scrap metal yard. You were there for a year. Did your experiences in the world of work make you think about yourself or your future differently?
No, I mean, no, I don't think so. What it made me realise is that I could talk to anybody. I could feel comfortable with all sorts of people, and the people I worked with in the scrapyard, who are mainly black guys. I felt totally at ease with them. I didn't feel self-conscious, or I didn't feel superior. At the same time, I still, you know, had this very inquisitive, critical mind, and I wanted to. And I didn't, you know, it's not a question of questioning why everybody doesn't have a very inquisitive, very critical mind. You know, but that, you know, that was there. And I had high hopes that in university it was going to be incredibly intellectually stimulating, exciting place. But as I said, I felt at ease with the people I worked with in Scrap Metal Yard. And that, you know, that made... In subsequent years, that made, you know, made the adjustment in prison so much easier.
So after a year working in the scrapyard, you went to Cambridge to study English, but you weren't really prepared for the type of people you encountered at Cambridge.
Well, there were certain, you know, as we discovered towards the end of my time then, when we occupied the Senate building and so on, there were these, where you knew the rowing club and the rugby club and these, and there were all these eating and drinking clubs of the very upper class people. You knew that they were, you know, basically reactionary people who were going to perpetuate their own class rule and felt totally confident about it. And I remember I had a friend from school who was in a, you know, he had a room somewhere, and I went to visit him, and the guy next to him was some old Etonian guy, and he just... You know, he couldn't believe that somebody, and I don't have much of an accent, but I have a little bit of an accent. He couldn't believe this guy that somebody like myself was there. So his shock was matched by my shock at his attitude.
And it was here you became involved with doing radical street theatre and you met the Situationists. What were they like?
Well, I shouldn't exaggerate about it. I mean, there were Situationist ideas that had come about because of this a student pamphlet where some French Situationist students had taken over the Students' Union and spent all the money that the union had on putting out this publication, which excited us because it was very contemptuous of conventional leftism in a way that certainly rang bells, because the leftist politics in Cambridge at the time was pretty appalling, really. I remember when I, in my first year there, I had Dennis Healy'd come to speak, and I'd been heckling Dennis Healy, and people were shocked. People sitting around me were shocked that I should be heckling a Labour who's a Minister of Defence. I mean, it was about, you know, it was about nuclear. I was heckling about nuclear weapons. And then in October 68, I went to anti-Vietnam march, and I got arrested and battered by the police, which changes you. You realise. You know, this is... I realised two things. One, on this demonstration, sort of, I'd ended up on the front line and we were charging the police with all these people shouting forward behind us. And then you look round and they're still yards and yards behind you and you're on your own. So you get a bit wary, and you know, it's a very politicising event to be arrested and bashed about.
I'm sure it is. Can you tell us about your next record?
My next record is, I don't really like guitar music. I don't really like sort of guitar group. I like the Rolling Stones, you know, at first. That was very exciting, that their very first record with Route 66 and Carol. But you know, normally I didn't particularly like this music. But I did like... they had a name for being this really decadent band, the Velvet Underground, but I liked them musically as well. It was a different way the guitar was different. It kind of had a rolling thing to it, and I've chosen from that a short section from a song, Sister Ray, it happened that when I was in Wormwood Scrubs in 1974, we managed to bullshit. There was four of us musicians, and we managed to bullshit this assistant governor into letting us practice, and actually got via a music teacher, we got together some amps and a speaker, and we actually did a performance in front of the... This was when Wormwood Scrubs was still a maximum security wing. We did a performance there, and Sister Ray was the last thing, last number that we did.
Rosie and the three on. They're busy waiting for her booster. Who just got back from Carolina. She said she didn't like the weather. They're busy waiting for her sailor. Just a big liver. He's just here from Alabama. He wants no way to earn a dollar. I'm searching for my manus. I said I couldn't hit it sideways. I couldn't hit it sideways. Oh, just like Sister Ray said. Lay it on.
That was Sister Ray by The Velvet Underground. You boycotted your final exams at Cambridge. Can you talk a little about the thinking behind that protest?
Having, you know, in a very generalised, vague way, comes to sorted out our politics a bit and decided that elitism was the real... was the real political thing that you had to fight, and that we here we were at the apex of the educational elite, and that we would at least, we would make, I mean, it looks probably looks silly now, we would make this gesture of ripping up our exam papers. And the street theatre actually evolved from that in the months leading up to actually ripping up the papers. We had a march of the academic cripples and a street theatre of that kind.
And you returned to London after Cambridge. Were you a very different person to the 18-year-old who had such a great time at places like Ronnie Scott's old place on Gerrard Street? How had you changed?
Yeah, I felt a bit harder. I felt a bit hard. You know, the thing about the exams was... the thing about the exam papers was it was kind of... You know, it was a kind of point of no return. I mean, it might not... It might, you know, potentially it might not have been. And, it, you know, it isn't in the final result. But at the time, it was definitely a cut-off from... from many career patterns that we might have had, so I felt much harder and more, I felt, you know, I felt more antagonistic to the capitalist elitist setup.
Can you talk a little about your next choice of music?
Yeah, my next choice of music is it's Joe Gibbs' Earthquake Dub. A dub music, which is what I still like the most, actually, of all musics, what I listen to a lot of the time. Well, you have to hear for yourself. I think dub music has a way of... I just think it has this fantastic rhythm where you don't have to work very hard to pick it up. You don't have to work hard to move to it. It's great stuff. And I heard it. I started to hear it. You know, in the 1974, I think, when at last we were able to get radios in prison. Maybe 1973, we got radios, and you would locate John Peel, who was very important to us in prison. I'd like to emphasise this: that Peel was incredibly important. To the whole, or nearly everybody in prison who was under 30 or under 35, because he played incredibly wide variety of music you wouldn't hear, and he played dub music. And then a couple of years later, we were even allowed in record players, and a friend of mine in the prison had this Joe Gibbs Earthquake Dub, and we used to sit and listen to it.
That was Joe Gibbs with Earthquake Dub. You used to go to the Marquee Club a lot. In fact, it was here you saw your first ska band. To what degree was there a political dimension to the music you liked?
Well, the thing about ska, I like the rhythm of ska, which was, again, it was different to rock music, and this was important. But also, ska had a lot of the same attributes as calypso. Calypso is often commentating on current events, and a lot of early ska songs, you know, were doing that as well. And also because it was, I mean, again, you know, people, it's hard to imagine now, but in, you know, still in the mid to late 1960s, there was an awful lot of racism, and ska was politically important in that it did start to, it was one of the things that started to break down certainly racism amongst young people.
I'd like to ask you briefly about the time before your arrest, about the Angry Brigade and about the idea of showing people in power that their actions had a consequence. Can you talk about that for a moment?
You know, we had a feeling that people were making, there were people in power making decisions that had, you know, impact, usually negative impact on the lives of thousands of other people. Who they didn't know, who they had, you know, who they appeared to have no interest in, certainly would, and they would make these decisions, as I said, affecting thousands of other people with no, you know, the consequences were all for these unknown, inferior other people. And that there were no consequences for them. It's about this, you know, that I am a good Marxist, but I do believe that we have to understand that elitism is the brother of exploitation. And if you think that, then, you know, you have to try and challenge elitists in every way you can.
And you have emphasised before now that the Angry Brigade were not like warrior monks devoted to forging a new future and thinking of nothing else. You were having a great time going out, listening to music and taking drugs. You've also talked about an underlying sense that it couldn't last, that the state wouldn't let it last. To what degree do you think your hedonism and your radical activism were a response to the same set of circumstances?
There was mass hedonism, and it wasn't, you know, consumer stuff. It wasn't like what it would become, that hedonism was totally related to consuming commodities. It was much more, it was far more creative than that. And you knew that this, my own belief is that they, you know, our parents probably were being paid for having fought World War II for them. And that they were, you could see they were getting to the point where they'd say, well, bugger that, you know, we've paid them now. And when they saw that the children of these people like us were, in from their point of view, taking the piss, but from our point of view, that there was a feeling of you know, mass hedonism and a creative kind of hedonism, which, you know, which went across, you know, which was actually particularly working class. And, you know, plus the fact that there was a high degree of labour militancy. I think that these things in subconscious way coalesced in our minds and thinking they're not going to put up with this, that it's too much, that what's happening here is a challenge to what I can only describe as social discipline. And again, this is exploitation involves, is also capitalism is both a system of, is an economic system of exploitation, but it's also a system of social control. And I think that sometime at the end of the 60s, in the early 70s, there was a decision that social discipline, absolutely the same in the United States, that social discipline was being undermined and something had to be done about this.
So in 1971, you were arrested with others and charged with causing explosions. You chose to conduct your own defence. Can you tell us a little about the thinking behind that?
The thinking about that was that the crucial, the people who really mattered were the jury, and that what we had to do was to make the jury confident in this very intimidating place. And I believe this now. I think, you know, juries are our only defence against, you know, a complete taking away of our civil liberties, and it's why they're, you know, under threat. All the jury system is under the threat all the time. And so that was the thinking was that that we had to make the jury confident in this very intimidating number one court at the Old Bailey. And that part of that then was that we couldn't afford, or not all, you know, we had to have one or two people who were not going to be relatively speaking ciphers, you know, who had this lawyer doing everything for them, so that you would, you know, and that in a sense you had to, if you defended yourself, you had a chance of the jury getting to know you as a real person and not as this complete mad fanatic, but as a, you know, reasonable human being. That was the thinking behind it.
What was your defence?
My defence was that in their keenness to convict people, they had I probably had an idea, had done certain of the Anger Brigade things, that they fitted us up.
Mm. And can you tell us a little bit about your next piece of music?
And my next piece of music now is now I'm out and about again. As I think I've said, in prison, we did this performance, including Sister Ray, and then I got really turned on to dub music. And when I came out of prison, a guy who I'd another very kind of up tempo reggae singer called Toots and the Maytals, I'd always liked. When I came out, I was lucky enough to see him live about three or four times in quite a short period of time after I was released from prison. And Pressure Drop is a really cheery number.
That's Toots and the Maytals, Pressure Drop. So after 7 years of your 10-year sentence, you were released from prison. That must have been a difficult adjustment to make.
Well, it is, as I believe many people have said, you have this, you come out of prison and there's a mixture of elation and, you know, sadness about leaving, particularly a lot of Irish Republican friends I'd left behind in the jail. But the funny thing is it all felt completely normal, actually. It didn't. I think the first thing I did, I didn't have any shoes. I went and bought some shoes. I mean, on my way back, because my girlfriend and co-defendant who'd got parole was living in Swansea in Wales, and we were driving back to Swansea from Worcestershire. I went in and bought some shoes, and it all felt completely normal.
And did you think the world had changed?
In 1975, I thought we have lost, that there, you know, they have re-established this discipline via a whole set of different mechanisms, mainly economic, that we thought was going to happen. And then the last gasp of it had been the Portuguese Revolution, And, you know, when that was defeated as well, I think that was like the, you know, then you really knew. So it was, it was a more pessimistic time. And then by, you know, and I remember, you know, being very politically active and heckling David Owen about Ireland, in fact, in the general election. But then the general election was won by Thatcher. And this, of course, well, this changed a lot. This did change a lot. And you knew that this, I knew that, I thought that Thatcher winning was in fact cementing this defeat.
Can you talk about your next record?
My next piece of music is by Abdullah Ibrahim, who at the time this record was made was called Dollar Brand, it's now called. He's also a South African jazz musician, piano player. Also many years in exile. And I think, you know, that exile, you know, exile can be very difficult, I think, especially if you come from, you know, even those must have been very hard for all black people in South Africa, you know, with this fabulous climate and all the rest of it. You know, it must have been a hard experience. And whenever I've had hard times, which I've had quite a fair number of hard times since I got out of prison, Dollar Brand has he has a kind of graceful, stately gracefulness that you know, makes you feel, you know, glad to be a, you know, glad to be a human being.
That's Abdullah Ibrahim performing African Marketplace. John, I know you're a great fan of the Notting Hill Carnival and you have been for many years. Why do you enjoy it so much?
Because it's, because it survived. You know, when I first went in the 67, 66 or 67, I mean, it was an incredible achievement. It was an incredible achievement to actually have that carnival by the black people, mainly from Notting Hill, you know, against a lot of, you know, because this is a time when the police were very heavy in, particularly against black people in the Notting Hill area. So I've always felt this was a really, it was an achievement that it should have ever happened. And it's always faced hostility. But for me, it's a moment of, you know, it's, I mean, they have the police are there, but it's basically a self-policed event of, you know, it's now a million and whatever number of people. And for me, it's a moment of absolute freedom. I feel completely free on these 2 days. That you can just, you know, you just go out onto the street and, you know, you're going to have a good time. And it is very still, you know, despite the size of it, it's still kind of local, and a lot of local people still make, you know, they make part of their income in those couple of days with food stalls and the rest of it. Yeah, but for me, it's that, you know, because I haven't, unfortunately, I wasn't in Portugal in 74, 75. I've never been in a situation of, you know, a revolutionary situation. But Carnival is this 2 days, yeah, of feel complete freedom.
Can you talk about your final piece of music?
Well, my final piece of music is from Shostakovich's 10th Symphony, which I think was written as Shostakovich. Well, Shostakovich, first of all, is a hero of mine because here is an artist who navigated himself against Stalin, and, you know, to understand that Stalin took a great interest in artists. He believed, that's the perverse thing about Stalin, he believed that they were very important and had to be policed by him. And this kind of long-term, you know, his surveillance of Shostakovich's music and the way that Shostakovich managed without compromising. And this music celebrates the survival of Leningrad during the Great War. And it's particularly on the desert island, one can occasionally think that one might like to feel a certain fighting spirit. And this gives it.
So that was Shostakovich and his 10th Symphony. Now, John, we give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. Which other book would you like to take to your island?
Is this one book or it's a volumes?
Oh, very clever.
Well, I don't know. I would like to have the 50 volumes of Marx and Engels, which is incredible, you know, because they're bohemians. They're real bohemians, as well as being these very people with great curiosity and intellect. But if we can't have 50 volumes, which is maybe pushing it a bit, if I can't take that, I'd take James Joyce's Ulysses, which even though it's not popular reading, it is in fact a celebration of tolerance and ordinary people. I think Leopold Bloom is one of the great humanist characters in fiction, would also on this island give one give a sense of a tolerant humanist person. It would give you that feeling.
And if you can take one luxury, what would it be?
I think a shortwave radio. I mean, not one that I could transmit from. You know, that might be pushing us. I wouldn't be on the desert island for very long. But shortwave radio that you could receive, shortwave radio broadcasts.
And if a huge wave came and washed away all your records but one, which one would you want to save?
It would be the Abdullah Ibrahim.
John Barker, thank you for telling us your Dissident Island discs.